Let's have an AA meeting. My name is Karen, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Karen.
Welcome to the Monday night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the Nabucco, where members of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tell his or her story. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is an amazingly powerful woman in AA, and I say that with all the love in my heart. Not power because she's the president of any group or anything like that, but she has what so many of us want. And it's such a pleasure to be able to introduce to you all tonight, and I'm going to blow it because I have to say your name without saying your last name, Meredith. Thank you. Oh my gosh. I want to thank Tim for inviting me here, and I want to thank my readers, my speed readers. I asked them to go as fast as you can because I'm dying. No. I'm sure you can hear me. Okay. My name is Meredith McCabe, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's a privilege to do anything for Alcoholics Anonymous. The program outlined in the textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and the fellowship keeps me grounded and keeps me on a very meaningful and fruitful path. So if I can help, I like to be there. And I always pray that I just reach the one who's still suffering. And I get nervous. I used to get nervous like when I first woke up in the morning and just, you know, freaked out all day about speaking. And now I don't worry that much. It hit me at 10 of 8. And I'll settle down here in just a minute. All right, so my sobriety date is May 30th, 1998. My home group it's in the book. We meet on Saturday mornings and Sunday nights at 8111. I have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor others. And I love that feeling of just being a link in the chain. You know, it's just really cool. All right, so what I was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I didn't start drinking until I was 10. It was Thanksgiving. I'd already had plenty of cherries and Manhattans that my parents had. Their cocktail parties looked like something out of Mad Men. It was just like that. And they'd have cocktail parties in the adult area, and I'd have to be upstairs with my other four brothers and sisters. There would be a fifth. There's six altogether, but for the most part, there were five of us, and I'd have to go to the children's area, and I knew that's not where it was at. I mean, I'd hear the laughter and the tinkling of the glasses and the smoke and everything. I was like, the party is downstairs. And I'd always loved alcohol. I loved the smell of it when my father kissed me goodnight. I loved the smell of sherry. I loved those bourbon-soaked cherries. And on that Thanksgiving, when Grandma said, oh, Rod, let the kids have a little champagne, what could it hurt? And we had these beautiful little glasses, and they're about an ounce. And I drank mine, and my brother hated his, so I drank his. And then I drank my sister's, and I had about 4 ounces of champagne, and it went, you know, right down my throat, and kaboom! You know, and it tingled, and my face got red, and my ears got red, and I just loved it. It felt magical. And it was an interesting day because I played piano for my Aunt Ginger, and I hate playing the piano. I did somersaults. I did all kinds of stuff. I was very showy-offy, and I found that I got a lot of attention when I did that. So that's kind of stuck with me for a while. But then I remember I suddenly needed a nap, and then I woke up from the nap, and I had a terrible, terrible headache. But I also remember going to school and telling my friends, oh my gosh, we had champagne at Thanksgiving, and I can't wait till Christmas because we have champagne on Christmas too at my house. And I meant it. And you know, up until then, all I really wanted for Christmas was this snuggle bun dolly. I just wanted this snuggle bun, but now I'm thinking about the champagne. And it was kind of neck and neck all the way to Christmas. You know, and you know, the book talks about if we're alcoholic, we have an obsession of the mind, and an obsession is something, it's a persistent and often unreasonable idea that cannot be put out of the mind. And it was, obviously, I didn't obsess at the age of 10, but it was there. I never forgot that feeling. And it also says that if we are alcoholic, we have this physical allergy, so that once we drink, we have little control over the amount we take. And unfortunately for me, I was to learn that I was pretty much alcoholic out of the gate. The first time I had a chance to really do any drinking on a regular basis, I was 14. And I grew up in a very small town. Well, actually, I moved to a very small town. I was from the suburbs of New York City, and we moved to a very small town in the Adirondacks where there were only 23 people in my high school class. So I was, like, you know, in every club, and I was president of everything I'd get my hands on. And, you know, I had to be very involved. I liked all that. And but I felt like an outsider. You know, everybody up there had one of, like, three last names. And if you didn't have one of those, you were, like, out, you know. And so I didn't really feel like I fit in. And I don't know where that comes from, but they say a lot of us feel that way. And I was well-liked. I mean, that came from me because people liked me, but I just didn't feel like it. Anyway, so I got a chance to start drinking. The cool kids, you know, met on the corner. You know, Bill's story, I discovered liquor in the midst of excitement, and that was the blinking traffic light, you know, in a town of like 1,200 people. And, you know, someone 18 years old would go buy a bottle of Boone's Farm, and I'd drink half of it, and I'd save the other half for the next night. It was just right until I decided maybe a little more would be better. And so I drank a whole bottle of apple wine and then vomited all over Jerry Rosenbaum's car. And I remember having just the worst headache the next day, and all I could think of was, well, I'm just not going to drink that much. And it didn't occur to me that I was going to stop or anything. I blacked out when I was 16, and I remember I drank a whole bunch of screwdrivers and threw up a bunch of potato chips. I remember that. And then the next morning, my best friend Midge said, I am never drinking again. She was dry heaving on our front lawn. And I was just like, well, I'm just never having screwdrivers again. I mean, seriously. So I didn't know that. But what I know now is that's you know, this, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I like the way it makes me feel. And I don't learn from one consequence or two consequences. I need pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization in spades. Right? So I drank, you know, alcoholically from get-go, and I found that pretty soon I was doing things when I got drunk that I was ashamed of. You know, I was a high honor student in school, and I was in the student council, and I was a cheerleader, mostly so I could ride the player's bus, but that's just me. But I also then on weekends would drink too much and do things I was ashamed of, and then I'd go back to school on Monday and spend all my time trying to overcome that and try to win people back. So I was leading that double life very early on. I was a good student, and I was a good daughter. I was the oldest. I made lunches. I vacuumed. I did all that. My parents split up, and I hit the streets. And on the weekends, I drank too much and did stuff I wish I hadn't done. And every time I'd say, it's going to be different next time. It's going to be different next time. And it wasn't. And it was like that for a long time. And, you know, I don't think that I know now that alcoholism is not a disease of character, but it certainly affected my character. You know, and it robbed me of my own self-worth little by little. You know, I went to college. I went to a women's college because the combination of alcohol and boys seemed to be bad for me. So I went to my high school boyfriend and I talked about it, and he said, maybe you can go to a women's college and that might help. I mean, some kind of external control on me, you know. But I soon found, you know, townies and foosball, and the game was on again, you know. And it seemed like every time I had really kind of run my course, wherever I was, it was time to move on. I graduated college. I went in there as a nursing major, and I came out with a self-initiated major in drama and literature, which doesn't really buy potatoes. And, you know, self-initiated anything at this point is probably not a good idea. You know, so I came back, and I started getting a job third shift in a diner after I graduated magna cum laude from this college. And I have truckers calling me their little tomato. And my mom was sad about that. And that really wasn't where I expected I'd end up. So again, I'm not living up to the idea I had for myself. You know, I thought I was going to be like this, but I ended up over here. And with every one of those things, it takes its toll. And I'd want to be different. I wish I could be different, but it just kind of ended up the same. But I was a survivor, surviving my own self-sabotage pretty much. And I managed to, you know, get good jobs like waitressing and bartending. Bartenders and drug dealers were my heroes. You know, those guys had all the money and all the people and all the connections. And so my goal was to be head bartender, and by golly, I got there. And then I got fired from that. And I worked my way down to the local gin mill in a tourist town where I earned the nickname Nightmare. And that's because when I drink, I'm happy for a while, but chances are at some point I'm going to turn the corner and I'm going to you know, not, I might say something I don't like to you. The next day I'll wonder what I said, and I wonder why you're not talking to me, but I turn the corner because of all this bitterness I have toward myself and all this resentment and all this built up. So that's kind of how it went. I mean, that was ad infinitum. That was my life. I decided that I came down to Georgia in the 80s to visit my sister. There's a line about my sister in the Big Book. It says people of faith have a logical idea of what life is all about. And that was my sister and her family. And I come down and visit them, and they live in the mountains, and we drink sweet tea, and we have big suppers, and we play with the kids, and I'd go jogging, and I wouldn't smoke, and things would be great for a week. You know, then I'd go back to my life, and I would get right back to it, even though I'd swear, I'm going to change, it's going to be different. You know, that Monday morning, now I'm going to, it's going to be different this time. And I kept ending up in the same place. One of my favorite musicians who just died, David Bowie, said, I'm always crashing in the same car, you know, and that's what it was for me. So I decided, you know, moving to Georgia was the answer. You know, the problem is where I'm living, and I need to live closer to my sister, and maybe I can, so this will rub off, and I'll just learn how to live a better life. And all went well for a time until I got a waitressing job near the perimeter area and an apartment right near the local bar, which has since gone out of business. But I wonder if Whiskers went out of business because I stopped drinking. But I just took up residence there, and, you know, I would tell you that I didn't drink alone because I drank among you. But I would come in after work, and I'd be, you know, I'd say I'm not going to go in after work, but I'd get to that exit, and doesn't my car go that way? And I join the folks in the bar, and I'd sit close to the service bar so I could at least see the action and pretend I'm engaged with something, and have a couple of stiff vodkas, and I get that. And now I can talk to you. And hopefully I won't turn on you, but if I'm there long enough, I probably will. Yeah. And that went on ad infinitum for 10 years. And my last two friends when I was drinking were Pizza Sam and Toothless Joey. And that really, too, wasn't the way I pictured myself. I have some lovely, beautiful friends today, and they're not these... You know, my friend Sam is still friends with me on Facebook, and he's still one angry drinking guy. You know, and I just, you know, I send him messages with love. I started to suspect, obviously, that I really had a problem. My mother was alcoholic. I had a cousin who I lived with in the 80s, and she partied like me. And one day I was sitting in my underground apartment. The last two places I lived were subterranean. And I don't think I did that intentionally, but I wasn't living in the light of day anymore. And I remember when I was really sick and really remorseful about whatever occurred the night before, I would scurry to McDonald's, and I would scurry home, and I'd scurry to Kroger. You know, I didn't want anybody to see me. I couldn't wait to just get back home and try to get regrouped enough to get back out there and go to work. And as a manager, you know, I kept succeeding in my job. I held it together, but I pretty much ruled through intimidation. You know, my best defense was an offense, and it wasn't pretty. All right. So my cousin sends me a pamphlet. This crazy cousin who drank like me, lived like me, and had been in therapy since she was like four. And she sends me this pamphlet one day, and I open it up, and it has a sticky note on it. And it's a pamphlet, a letter to a woman alcoholic, that is now called AA for the Woman. And she just had a sticky note saying, I love you a lot. I just wanted you to have this. I know we are a lot alike. I just got 1 year sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started reading that pamphlet, and before I was done with the first page, I was in tears because it spoke to me. And it's interesting that to this day, it's the literature that really speaks to me. Even the forewords. You know, the foreword to the third edition says, it's the program that is the same everywhere we go. The fellowship means that it's the program. The foreword to the fourth edition talks about the literature, and they rephrase Big Book like in 12 different ways on a page and a half. It's all about the Big Book. And that's where the integrity of the message is. And I didn't know anything about that. But that literature had, you know, it got my attention. So I set off on America's Program of Action, which is go straight to work, drink a lot of tomato juice. I don't know why my dad did that when he was hungover, so I just picked that up as a little trick. And I'd go to Blockbuster, and I'd scurry home, and I wouldn't answer the phone. And for 23 days of that, I was happy, joyous, and free. Couldn't go out, couldn't answer the phone. Hated my life, you know. But I was not drinking. And I remember telling the controller at work, I said, I'm going to AA. And she's like, that's great. You know, nobody was like, really? Why? You know? But I was no more in AA than I was in the Boy Scouts. I was going to meetings. I was going to this one they have at 10 o'clock at night in the dark. And I'd go late and I'd run to the back and I'd run the gauntlet and I'd sit in the back and listen to topics. And, you know, they were really crazy topics. And I felt like I could weigh in on some of them, you know. But I really didn't know what was going on. And I read the steps, and I honestly thought that steps were for the people that didn't have the cars and the jobs and the wives. Those are good. That's a good idea right there. But I really just thought going to meetings was going to be good. And I lasted about 90 days, and I went back out. And, you know, for me, step two was, you know, coming to AA. I mean, I knew I was powerless over alcohol because I could not stop drinking when I wanted to, and I couldn't stay stopped. And there's a definition in the book that says, this is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. It's this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. And I started having wish when I was 16 and showing up in the back of muscle cars every time you turn around. And by the time I got into college and I ended up with a self-initiated major that I couldn't do anything with, and then just hating myself and my life. And missing all the milestones I thought I was going to make. So anyway, so I came to AA, so I knew that, I mean, I already knew I was powerless, that I couldn't do it. And I came to AA, and to me, that's a step two action, you know. And getting a sponsor, you know. If I come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity, I didn't have a problem with the insanity piece. Because as I tried to stop drinking in the last 5 or 6 years of my life, I would recall an incident that would make me feel remorseful, or it would flash through my mind, and then the next thought was slitting my wrists or putting a gun in my mouth. I could taste the metal. And that was not the way I thought as a person. I knew that I didn't have those thoughts a few years back. These were obsessive thoughts. So when I learned about the obsession later about alcohol, I got it, because these thoughts about wanting just to kill myself and end it were coming uninvited, countless, daily. I was in such mental torture. And so when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't know until I started listening to this one woman who every time she shared for like an hour. But she would talk about how she self-diagnosed and she'd gotten into this book and she had to diagnose herself according to what this said. And if she was what this said, then the answer would work for her. And every time she talked, I'd be like, yeah, that's it, that's it. I didn't know what it was. I know now what it was. She had a power. She had power. And she had confidence that she'd overcome this. She had overcome this. She wasn't eking it out one day at a time. I'll wear it because she didn't drink today. She had overcome something. And that was interesting to me. The doctor's opinion says the message that can interest and hold us must have depth and weight. And that her message had depth and weight. So much so that I was too afraid to ask her to sponsor me. It took like 3 times. And when I finally asked her to be my sponsor, oh my God, I went up to her and I said, will you be my temporary sponsor? And she said, do you want temporary sobriety? I'm like, I don't know. I didn't know I could have permanent sobriety. And she pulled out a book. She said, right here, page 15, vital to no, here. Oh, I can't remember. It's not 15. It's another one close, though. And it says something like, strenuous work when alcoholic with another is vital to permanent recovery. I'm like, oh my gosh, I didn't know it could be permanent. I mean, no lie. Like, wow. And then she said, have you been sober before? I said, yes, I had 90 days and I chose to drink again. She said, really? You chose to drink again? I said, well, you know, that's right here. She said, says right here, in italics, we alcoholics have lost the power of choice in drink. You know, at certain times we have no effective mental defense against the first drink. Can't remember the pain and suffering of a week or a month ago. And I was thinking, can I please change my answer? Because I realized that was true. I can't tell you how many Sunday nights. Because even as classless as I was going to a bar where at least I could be like bell of the bar, you know. But even I had a rule. You don't go out drinking on a Sunday night. A respectable woman who's a general manager in a nice restaurant doesn't go out drinking on a Sunday night. And yet I'd be pulling in there in tears because I could not go. And so I knew I was drinking against my will. So she had me at my interest right at snap. And then I said, so will you be my sponsor? She says, yes, and here's what I want you to do. I'm like, wow, I don't even know her. But she said, do you have a big book? I said, yes. I had it 13 years ago. I had it for 13 years and just carried it around. You know, not like literally, but from house to house that I moved to, my big book was always there. By the time I finally cracked it, it smelled like mildew. So anyway, so I asked her, you know, so she started putting me through these actions. And, you know, and how it works is, if you are willing to, if you want, we have, and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. Well, I didn't know that. I was just following your direction. And actually, I was feeling better. You know, I was pissed off at the same time. I was like, I have to go to certain meetings. I have to call her early. I have to clean out cigarettes, and I don't even smoke anymore. And coffee cups and all that stuff, and say hello to two women and remember their names. I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm in the weeds. You know, I had to write this stuff down. I was managing a restaurant, and I still needed to make a list of the stuff I had to do in AA. I got this girl. She's got 4 days right now. She came to the meeting on Saturday morning. She's like, I've had a bad morning. She goes, I had to do chores. I had to read. I had to call you. I said, no! So anyway, I remember, and my sponsor told me, no sharing in meetings. I want you to listen to learn and learn to listen. I went to a women's meeting, and they were all complaining about their sponsors. Like, I can't even share about my sponsor, because she said, I can't share. But, it, you know, she told me the most spiritual thing I could ever do is hold my tongue. And I got to tell you how that's really paid off for me. Okay, so then finally after she puts me through these paces, and I'm, I don't know, when am I going to work this ass, you know? She says, okay, Saturday morning, come to my house, bring enough food to last all day, because I know you're diabetic, and I don't want you passing out on me. And she said, and bring your big book. And I'm like, okay, but I don't know where she lives. There's no Google Maps. I don't know how early I have to get up to get over there. I mean, I was just... But I made it, and so I go in her house, and she goes, you know why you're here? And I said, we're going to work some steps. And she said, I'm going to take you through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm like, all of them? She said, have measures, they lost nothing. You know, she's all excited. You know. So, you know, step three, you know, we said a prayer on step one. She said, you've already arrived at step three. You've already admitted your powers over alcohol, and your life's unmanageable because I'm managing you. And I'm like, oh, yeah, no wonder I'm so pissed off, you know? And then came to believe that a power greater than myself. I believe that, too, because I was coming to these meetings, and I knew there was something here. And between the time I asked her to be my sponsor and the time I took the steps, I took a road trip up to New York. And I counted church steeples all the way up through the Shenandoah Valley. I've never done that. I mean, there was something, and as soon as I was willing to start going down that path, God started showing up. And I had such a peace about looking at all these steeples. It was just like, all these steeples? Can all these steeples be wrong? You know? And it really, it started to move in me. And that's why the third step promises are my favorite. It says, being all powerful, he provided what we needed as long as we, you know, stay close to him and performed his work well. So, third step. Made a decision and a prayer. That was it. We got down our knees. She said the third step prayer. I was looking over at her. She was completely hooked up. I was not so much. But I was just copying what she was doing. And the book says, you know, once we've done this step, sometimes a great effect is felt at once. And a friend of mine in AA said, and sometimes not. And that was my experience. I didn't really feel anything. But it, for me, it was a decision to do four. And she had assigned pages 1 through 57 to me for all those days up until that day. So from the day I asked her to be my sponsor until 3 months later, I read from the blank page to 57 over and over and over again. And I knew that the answer was the searching and fearless moral inventory and that God is on the inside. And that was a tremendous fact for me because I didn't know that. I looked for God on top of mountains. I looked for God, in, you know, along the rivers. I looked for God in those muscle cars. And the only place I found him was deep within. And it says, in the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It's an analysis. So it's not just me sitting around thinking about, gee, let's see, I'm kind of rotten, I stole a little bit. It's an analysis. And it was pen to paper. And I love how there's a line that says, however you approach God really doesn't make a difference to us. That's a matter for you to decide. Which tells me at some point people started arguing about format. You know, how many columns are there? That's a good meat topic right there. I didn't use columns. My sponsor got cards passed down from the home brewmeister through my family line. And there were questions I had to answer, and they were very provocative. And they helped. And they were about the same things, resentments and fears and harms, but it was just a different way to do it. And it kept catching you up. Do you have any secret you want to add there? And then another question, you know, three questions later. How about a secret? You know, because they read those secrets. You know? And when I was done writing, she gave me her fifth step. And then that made it easier because I didn't realize I was so terrible. And then I gave my fifth step and I'll tell you, the relief I felt, people say it's a spiritual experience, I don't know, but I just know I've never done anything that thorough or that honest, and that's what it says the qualifications of the fourth step is, thoroughness and honesty. It doesn't really matter about format. It's really, this whole process is to introduce us to 10, 11, and 12 as a lifetime practice. So this is just showing me in a long version how to do it. You know, 100 forms of fear, self-seeking, self-pity, dishonesty. And at the root of our trouble, which is the part where something begins, is my self-centeredness. So, and I look at that, and it was cool about, after doing 4 and 5, when she saw my paper, she goes, "So, that's the result of your will and your life. How do you like it?" I'm like, I've been crying for like hours. And she said, "Well now, are you ready to get rid of it?" "Yes, I am." Well, there's step 6. Step 6 for me was a landing place. After doing 4 and 5, yes, I was ready. And then I have to humbly ask God to remove my defects. I just discovered this word, like, recently in this book. I have to acknowledge the defects I find objectionable. You know, there were some things, I don't like to swear. I'm just going to say it. I like the F-bomb. And so when I first got sober, I didn't object to that. You know, I didn't really have much of an objection to that. But it, as I got more sober, and I would hear other people use that, I thought, gee, I do that a lot, and I don't like when they do it. So I had to admit, I swear too much, I write it down, I humbly, which means on my knees, that's what Bill intended, and that changes the relationship a good bit. And then suddenly, people are saying, boy, you swear a lot. You know, suddenly when I'm ready to admit it, I get all this influence saying, you know, confirming, yep, you do. You're on the right track. You know, defects. A car that has a defect, it gets recalled because it's missing a part to make it complete. If I am born with defects and I was created by God, there must have been a reason for that. And I think the reason is, so I have a need for Him. So that my defects are not always removed forever. They'll come back if I don't continue to mind this and humbly ask to remove, and then I can maybe progress, and all of it is in the name of being an instrument of God's peace, because that's where I get peace. But I think that my impatience or my intolerance or my unkindness or my sarcasm, oh, we looked up sarcasm last night, the big book study, because everybody thinks sarcasm is funny. Look it up. That's, you know, it talks about bitter and cutting and derision, and I'm like, funny, isn't it? You know, but it took me, you know, 12 years in sobriety to realize that I'm a smart aleck and I'm not really nice when I do it. I'm really trying to cut you down. It's not funny, but it wasn't. I didn't get to that until I was ready to get to that, and I love that. It's a path. When I did my 5th step, my sponsor made my 8th step list, and the book says we made it when we took inventory. By the time I was done talking to her, she had a list of people. And I thought, when am I going to go to Charlie? She said, you're leaving him alone. So I wasn't going to, that was a lifetime amends. You know, Charlie's safe there in Vermont. But we started with the easiest one, and then we went to the more difficult and the more difficult. And that's where I really started walking with God, because I had to pray, I had to follow the directions, and I had to go on my own. And when I looked the people in the eye that I hurt the most, my shame starts to fall away and the forgiveness comes, and then I can be more effective, and I'm not isolating so much, and I'm not hiding so much, and I'm not scurrying anymore, and somehow I feel a part of you finally. You know, working these steps made me feel like I got the secret handshake. You know, you know, I've never written cards, and it's a good thing, because I can't keep these steps in order to save my life. And with that, 5, 6, 7, humbly ask, great. Alright. What I love about the 9th step amends, there's great reading. It's like 8 pages, but there's some little lines that I love. One of them is, no matter what the situation, we usually have to do something about it. And I love that, because that says I can take, and it also says that we must take the lead in this long period of reconstruction. I love that, because that, I don't have to wait until, well, they hurt my feelings and they better come and tell me they're sorry or I'm not talking to them. If I want peace and I want to forgive and be forgiven, then I can take the lead on that. I can go. This happened last week at the office. There's a guy, he's out of sorts. He's just plain out of sorts. But when he starts to take it out on me for no reason, I sat there for a minute, and then I just went, have I upset you about something? I feel terrible if I've upset you about something. So don't know, you'd know it if you did. So I knew it was just him being a jerk. You know, at least it wasn't me, and I was fine with that. I was good. So what I like about the amends and the way we did it was, the first one, I had 1 week to do it. and then the next one, and then the next one. And what that has taught me over time is there's a sense of urgency about making things right. Not just so that people aren't walking around with hurt feelings, but so that I can shed that and have peace again. So I didn't know it then. I know that now, having practiced this. Step 10, this is a tricky one. It says in the book, we vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. And the way of living is to continue to look for fear, resentment, self-centeredness, dishonesty, and self-seeking. And when these crop up, ask God at once to remove them. Make amends if we need to, discuss them with someone who may not be affected, which sponsor, and then turn my thoughts to someone I can help. Now, I was introduced to doing a written 10-step, which is actually in the 11-step reading. And so for years, there's another good meeting topic. Where is step 10, you know? But this past summer, there was a woman at our Big Book study who was here from Australia for the international, and she had 26 years sober, and she had a whole new take on the 10th step, the written part on 11, which I did every night, which helps me look. You know, step 10 says continue to take personal inventory. Inventory is a list. There is no such thing as a list that isn't on paper. You know, but I don't think that we have to do that forever. I think that we get in the habit of looking at those things so that we can get better at the spot check, which is on 84. So I think the 11-step reading is really about how well did you do what was on the page before. You know, so it's an amazing program. And that's the other piece of it. I really have to apply it. You know, you wonder, is there, what kind of spirituality is there in making lists and all that stuff? But that's what it took for me to see where I wanted to go, see where I was and where I wanted to go. And I was one of those people that was mentioned in the doctor's opinion that I wanted to recreate my life. There was no part of my life that was really much good. I had some moments, and people would, you know, hopefully await the day I roused myself from my lethargy. But I always fell back. You know, I always fell back. And no one was more disappointed than I was. Step 11. Okay, humbly on my knees. My sponsor told me that I, from the very beginning, when she gave me those little lists of directions on what I should do. What time is it? Is it quarter of? Okay. She said, I want you to pray on your knees, morning and night. And I was raised in a religious upbringing, but that made me feel awkward. Awkward. But then I had to think, well, so is disrobing and whiskers, so I guess I could, you know, I guess I could pray on my knees and try it. And she said, keep it simple, you know, help me in the morning and thank you at night, you know, help me in the morning, thank you at night. Over time, after I first took the steps, I said the third step prayer a lot. I changed the V's and the vows to you and yours so it didn't sound so churchy. You know, but that's the one I said. Relieve my difficulties. Let me, you know, let victory over them be, evidence to you of God's power. And then as I have progressed in sobriety, I've prayed to be an instrument of God's peace. And I went through a big work crisis about 7 years ago, where I had to decide if I was going to stay or go. And I decided to go, and then I got really depressed and frightened, and wasn't sure how things were going to go. I didn't have any fear of financial insecurity on my first 4-step because I had plenty of money. Just never came up. But things changed, and it took me to a whole new level of dependence on God and having to slowly make choices about things I'm going to give up and things I'm going to keep really started to underscore what was important. And it brought me to a place where I could be more kind and more loving and more tolerant. On that journey, I met someone who was a chronic relapser and had survived cancer and was trying to get his life together. And his wife had left him with his son at 2.5 years old and moved across the country because he wouldn't stop putting him in a car when he was all wasted on morphine. And it was a long journey back for him. But he followed the program the same way I followed it, and we became friends. And we took this journey through a time when both of us had literally not much. And It was amazing. I had always, you know, put the cart before the horse in relationships, and it was the first time I'd ever really decided. I learned what sacrificial love was about, and I learned it by sponsoring women. You know, moving a girl from Jacksonville Beach on July 4th weekend, you know, taking someone through the steps on Super Bowl Sunday. I didn't even know I did that. A girl reminded me of that the other day. But it changed me. And I began to want more for someone else than I wanted for myself. And through it all, the short story is we ended up being very close, closer than I've ever been to anyone. He got a job in Phoenix. I got a job in Minneapolis, and we were separated for a long time. He just put it in the hands of God, but he got to be close to his son again, and his wife began, ex-wife began to let him see him again, and started to put his life together, and he introduced his son to a relationship with God and prayer and things like that, and it all went well for a while until he had surgery and stood up and died after the surgery. It was unexpected, and it was 2 weeks after my mother had died, and I'd been at my mother's side, and I'd visited her. No matter where I was working, I would come home from my travels and I would spend a night with her in Jasper. And someone who used to be a sarcastic brat, she started counting on the calendar. She goes, "You know that you've come and spent the night with me 9 times since Halloween? Give her a calendar." I'm like, you know, I'd make fun of her symphonies and her music she would play, and then we'd watch a movie together. And toward the end, she couldn't shower. She asked me if I could help her, and she goes, "But I want you to put your sunglasses on." So I went out to my car and got my sunglasses, and I came in and I got her ready for the shower, and she had her sunglasses on. But anyway, you know, I never would be able to get through all that if I did not have a relationship with God. If I did not, you know, the thing about the steps is, for me, I suspected there was God, I wished there was God, I had hoped there was God, but through this process, and then working with you and seeing evidence of God, you know, the book says we have found much of heaven. To me, that means I see evidence of God here on earth, and that has gone from a suspicion, a wish, a hope, to certainty. And certainty changes the game. Certainty makes us overcomers. You know, so it does for me anyway. So now that you know, Jeff's been gone almost 5 years. His son, who was 8 when I met him, is now 13, and in 27 days we are going snowboarding. That was the gift wrapped in black paper. I got to be friends with his little boy, and I'm his godmother. And he also says I am very cool. So, and it's just amazing. And his ex-wife and I are very close. It's an amazing thing. Step 12, you know, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. It is in trying to carry, period. It doesn't matter what happens on the other side. It doesn't matter what happens to them. I mean, it's great if they get sober, but I got to stick to try to carry and not get all involved and tell them, you know, and work with them. And my sponsorship style has changed over the years to become more compassionate and more customized to meet them where they are. But they still have to hit the markers, because they have to show me they're willing. It cannot be just fantasy. So it's measurable, you know, and it's a gift to be able to do it. You know, people say, "How do you do that?" I don't know what else I would do. I had the best weekend this weekend, and I can't remember I used to, if only, you know, I don't have a Valentine. It never even crossed my mind. You know, it's just, you know, it's a personality change, it's a change in attitude, and it's a result of these steps and the fellowship that has grown up around me. Nightmare. All right, so I want to just finish up with something from Dr. Bob's Nightmare. It says, "I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learn to others who want and need it badly. I do it for 4 reasons. 1, sense of duty. 2, it is a pleasure. 3, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. 4, because every time I do it, I take a little more insurance for myself against a slip. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. If you still think you are strong enough to beat the game alone, that is your affair. But if you really and truly want to quit drinking liquor for good and all, and sincerely feel that you must have some help, we know that we have an answer for you. It never fails if you go about it with 1/2 the zeal you have been in the habit of showing when you were getting another drink. Your Heavenly Father will never let you down." Thank you.
Wow. Thank you. I have known bits and pieces of your story, but wow, that's all I can say. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And the thing about whispers, I think I was there when you were there. And I know that's why they're closed. I'm a plane in the sky. Without you, I cannot fly. You lift me up.
Yeah.